And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep that pencil and recycled paper handy. And we're going to get right on into our commentary, as we do each week at the beginning of the second half of the recorded portion of the show. This commentary is written by Paul Epstein of the Washington Post, and the title is West Nile, It's Not Just Local, It's Global. Just as the buzz about West Nile virus has begun to recede in the Northeast, infected birds are being reported in Maryland and in the District of Columbia, and there is news of an Israeli outbreak that has claimed at least 19 lives. Beyond the obvious lessons to be drawn from these scares, there is a link that has not yet been recognized. The conditions underlying outbreaks of this sometimes deadly virus can be traced to global environmental change. This is not the kind of distance, seemingly abstract effect most people associate with the threat of global warming, melting glaciers, eroding coastlines, and endangered species. It is something we can see in our own backyards. Named for the district in Uganda, it was first identified in 1937. The West Nile virus entered the Western Hemisphere in 1999, most likely, scientists believe, via migratory birds from Europe. While the precise means of introduction is not known, we do know the conditions that rev up the disease's life cycle. Mild winters coupled with prolonged droughts and heat waves, the long-term and extreme weather phenomenon associated with climate change. Since mosquitoes lay their eggs in water, the fact that drought can amplify transmission of diseases they carry may seem counterintuitive, but this is the case for the West Nile virus. Here's how it can happen. West Nile virus is transmitted by mosquitoes to birds and other animals with occasional spillover to humans. What makes it different from many other mosquito-borne illnesses is that its primary carrier is an urban-dwelling mosquito, Culex pipiens. Culex typically breeds underground in the foul water standing in city drains and catch basins. During a drought, these pools are even richer in the rotting organic matter that Culex needs to thrive. More rainfall would flush the drains and dilute the pools. Another group of mosquitoes, Aedes, breeds in open ponds and puddles. Some species of Aedes carry the West Nile virus, but not as efficiently as the Culex mosquito. Drought can also lead to a decline in the number of mosquito predators, such as frogs and dragonflies, and it encourages birds to congregate around shrinking water sites where the virus can circulate more easily. Meanwhile, high temperatures speed up the development of viruses within the mosquito carriers, who only live about 2 weeks. The faster a virus develops, the greater the chance that it will reach a dangerous, mature stage while the mosquito is alive and capable of biting. All these factors enhance the possibility that infectious virus levels will build up in birds and mosquitoes living in close proximity to human beings. And in the spring and summer of 1999, all these factors were present in the northeastern and mid-Atlantic states. The prolonged drought and intense heat, in particular the three-week heat wave that enveloped the northeast that July, lasted until the pendulum swung ferociously in the opposite direction, bringing torrential end-of-August rains. Culex thrived in the drought months, Aedes bred in the late summer floodwaters, and as is well known, a serious outbreak occurred. 7 New Yorkers died from the West Nile virus in 1999. 62 people were infected and survived. Many have reported chronic disabilities such as extreme muscle weakness and fatigue. In contrast, the unusually cool and wet weather this past spring and summer have reduced the threat of West Nile virus for humans. Indeed, only one death has occurred to date, that of an 82-year-old man in New Jersey. Public health measures included targeted spraying of pesticides and the application of chemicals and bacteria that kill mosquito larvae in storm drains were also apparently helpful. Meanwhile, however, Israel experienced a prolonged drought and intense heat this summer, conditions that may have helped create a serious outbreak that occurred there. Certainly there are other factors other than weather and climate that contribute to outbreaks of disease. Just as forestry practices fueled the fires ignited by lightning during this past summer's prolonged western drought, local environmental problems can increase the potential for mosquito breeding in urban settings. Antiquated urban draining systems leave more fetid pools where mosquitoes can breed, and stagnant rivers and streams do not adequately support healthy fish populations that consume mosquito larvae. But it was extreme weather events that allowed the West Nile virus to be launched with a vengeance into this hemisphere last year. Now, with the virus well established on America's eastern seaboard, wide swings in weather, the projected hallmark of global climate change, threaten to encourage mosquito breeding and spawn new outbreaks in the future. Weather extremes have played a significant role in the emergence and resurgence of dangerous diseases in the past. Lewis encephalitis, a disease that involved Culex mosquitoes, birds, and humans, made its appearance in St. Louis in 1933 during the Dust Bowl. A large outbreak occurred in California in 1984 following an extended dry spell. Hantavirus pulmonary syndrome, caused by a previously unknown virus related to the one that killed U.S. and U.N. workers during the Korean War, appeared suddenly in the southwestern United States in 1993. That disease is carried by rodents, and populations of the Paromyscus mantellus mouse, or deer mouse, had been boosted tenfold by a sequence of extreme weather conditions, years of drought that helped reduce its predators, followed by heavy winter rains that encouraged the growth of the mouse's food sources. 94 people were infected during the first year. 45 of them died. Since the mid-1970s, more than 30 diseases new to medicine have emerged. Old infectious diseases are resurging or reappearing where they have been eliminated, or, like West Nile, appearing where they have never been seen before. Factors contributing to this are deepening poverty in some areas, population movements, and medical and agricultural misuse of antibiotics. But the damage is compounded by local and global environmental change. The appearance of a mosquito-borne illness in northeastern cities underscores just how global environmental change can directly affect our lives. Diseases generated continents away can travel and spread, and no nation is immune. Public and personal health is inextricably tied to a stable climate and to economic development and healthy ecosystems on continents far away as well as at home. We have embarked on a precarious and uncertain global course. Just as we have underestimated the rate at which climate change is occurring, we have underestimated the sensitivity of biological systems to small changes in average temperatures and the accompanying weather instability. We cannot delay any longer. Restabilizing the climate must be a chief priority to protect our health and our well-being. Global warming is driven by the use of fossil fuels and the emission of heat-trapping gases into the Earth's atmosphere. This latest manifestation of global environmental change in our backyards underscores the urgency of altering the way our economies develop and the way we power that development. Paul Epstein is the Assistant Director for the Center for Health and the Global Environment at the Harvard Medical School, and we thank him for his commentary today here on Earth First Radio, and this appeared in the Washington Post Sunday, October 8th. Let's move into animal, plant, and habitat news. Here's a story by Andrew Revkin. Planting new forests can't match saving old ones in cutting greenhouse gases, a study finds. A new study has cast doubts on an important element of the proposed treaty to fight global warming, the planting of new forests in an effort to sop up carbon dioxide, a heat-trapping gas. The research concludes that old, wild forests are far better than plantations of young trees at ridding the air of carbon dioxide, which is released when coal, oil, or other fossil fuels are burned. The United States and other countries with large land masses want to use forest plantations to meet the goals of the proposed treaty, but the study's authors say that any treaty also needs to protect old forests, and that, so far, there is no sign that such protections are being considered. Without such protections, the scientists conclude, some countries could be tempted to cut down old forests now and then plant new trees on the deforested land later, getting credit for reducing carbon dioxide when they have actually made matters worse. The analysis, published in the journal Science, was done by Dr. Ernst Delf Schultz, the director of the Max Planck Institute for Biogeochemistry in Jena, Germany, and two other scientists at the institute. Several climate and forestry experts with the work said the study provided an important new argument for protecting old-growth woods. And they say the study provides a reminder that the main goal should be to reduce carbon dioxide emissions at the source, smokestacks, and tailpipes. In old forests, huge amounts of carbon taken up from the air are locked away not only in the tree trunks and branches, but also deep in the soil where carbon can stay for many centuries, said Kevin Gurney, a research scientist at Colorado State University. When such a forest is cut, he said, almost all of that stored carbon is eventually returned to the air in the form of carbon dioxide. Quote, it took a huge amount of time to get that carbon sequestered in those soils, he said. So if you release it, even if you plant again, it will take an equally long time to get it back. The German study, together with other similar research, has produced a picture of mature forests that differs sharply from long-held notions in forestry, Dr. Schultz said. He said aging forests are long perceived to be in a state of decay that releases as much carbon dioxide as it captures. But it turns out that the soils in undisturbed tropical rainforests, Siberian woods, and some German national parks contain enormous amounts of carbon derived from fallen leaves, twigs, and buried roots that can bind to soil particles and remain for 1,000 years or more. When such forests are cut, the trees' roots decay and the soil is disrupted, releasing the carbon dioxide. Centuries would have to pass until newly planted trees built up such a reservoir underground. New forests are fine as long as they are planted on land that was previously vacant, Dr. Schultz said, adding, but there has to be a focus on preserving the old growth. And talking about European forests, only one-third of Europe's trees are healthy, according to the European Commission's annual 2000 report on the continent's forests. 41% of trees were classified as being in the warning stage and 20% are damaged, says the report, which concludes that further cuts in air pollution are needed before forests can be sustainably managed. In good news off of the eastern shores of the United States, the National Marine Fisheries Service is closing a fishing area on the Grand Banks to protect loggerhead and leatherback sea turtles caught as bycatch by U.S. fishermen during Atlantic pelagic longline fishing operations. A total of 56,000 square miles will be closed from October 10th through April 9th of next year. Although fishermen do a good job of releasing sea turtles alive, we need to reduce the number of serious injuries and deaths of turtles hooked on pelagic longline gear, said National Marine Fisheries Service Director Penny Dalton. The closed area was selected to provide increased protection because of the large number of sea turtles that congregate there at this time of year. The emergency rule also requires all pelagic longline vessels that fish in the Atlantic Ocean, the Gulf of Mexico, the Caribbean Sea to carry and use dip nets and line clippers to aid in the removal of any fishing gear from captured sea turtles. This aspect of the emergency action was delayed 45 days to give fishermen an opportunity to acquire or fabricate the gear. After an assessment last year of sea turtle and fishery interactions, National Marine Fisheries Service scientists concluded that the operation of the Atlantic pelagic longline fishery is likely to continue to jeopardize the existence of threatened loggerhead and endangered leatherback sea turtles. The agency plans to release a new biological opinion about the impact of pelagic longline fisheries on sea turtles early next year. And the United States and Russia have agreed to joint management and preservation of a group of between 3,000 and 5,000 polar bears who move back and forth across the border north of the Bering Strait. Under the agreement signed in a ceremony at the State Department in Washington, D.C., they agreed to set up a joint commission to set an annual limit on the number of polar bears that native peoples can hunt or capture. Representatives of two groups of native peoples will have equal representation on the four-member commission alongside delegates of the two governments. The agreement applies to the distinct population of Alaska Chukotka polar bears, most of which breed on the Wrangel Island on the Russian border. In search of seals, their staple diet, the bears travel thousands of miles each year across the Chukchi Sea, mostly on ice floes. The agreement, which has been under negotiation for 8 years, limits hunting to native peoples of the area and prohibits certain types of hunting, such as taking of cubs, females with cubs, or bears in dens, hunting from aircraft, large boats, or vehicles, and using poisons, traps, or snares. The two countries also agree to cooperate in scientific research on polar bears. Altogether, the world has between 22 and 28,000 polar bears spread over territory controlled by Canada, Greenland, Norway, Russia, and the United States. The World Wildlife Fund says they face an uncertain future because of the effect on their environment of climate change, pollution, poaching, and overfishing. And the Nature Conservancy has purchased almost 27,000 acres of Zumwalt Prairie, the largest purchase of Oregon land in the organization's 50-year history. Zumwalt Prairie is North America's largest remaining expanse of native bunchgrass prairie. The remote site supports extraordinary wildlife populations, including the densest known concentration of breeding birds of prey in the nation. The new 42-square-mile Zumwalt Prairie Preserve is on the western rim of Hell's Canyon, where rolling grasslands drop off toward the Inaha and Snake Rivers. Abundant ground squirrels and other prey on the prairie attract dense populations of hawks, eagles, and owls, prairie falcons, and other birds of prey. 38 miles of creeks in the canyons include spawning grounds for endangered Snake River steelhead and other native fish. Two co-founders of an internet software company donated $5 million to jumpstart the fundraising for the new preserve, Glenn Boyd and Eli Shapira, said they were motivated by the opportunity to protect an extraordinary place for future generations. Quote, the unique characteristics of the Zumwalt Prairie made it an easy decision for Eli and me to participate in this land project, says Boyd, co-founder and president of WebTrends Corporation. Oregon is truly blessed with an abundance of natural wonders. We're ecstatic to be able to do our part in helping preserve this habitat of unsurpassed beauty for generations to come. The Nature Conservancy will raise $16 million to establish the Zumwalt Prairie Preserve, said Russell Holflick, the Nature Conservancy's Oregon director. That includes the $11.7 million purchase price, loan interest costs, new preserve startup, and an endowment to fund for the long-term management of the property. And the black-footed ferret, one of North America's most endangered mammals, returned to tribal lands in South Dakota today. The reintroduction, actually a few days ago, the reintroduction of about 50 wild and captive-bred ferrets was planned by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in partnership with the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. The ferrets were released into a large black-tailed prairie dog colonies located on the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation along the Missouri River. Black-footed ferrets are dependent upon large prairie dog colonies for food and shelter. The return of the black-footed ferret to our lands is an important part of restoring our cultural heritage, said Tribal Chairman Greg Borland. We're happy to cooperate in this national effort by making available one of the last best places for ferret conservation. The ferret reintroduction is part of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe's prairie management plan to restore and maintain native prairie ecosystems. The plan focuses on range management, prairie dog ecosystem management, bison enhancement, black-footed ferret reintroduction, and public education. The service has been working with the tribe since 1994 to prepare for the reintroduction. This reintroduction plays an important part in reestablishing the prairie ecosystem and once again illustrates the delicate balance between the many varied species that inhabit the West, says Ralph Morgenreck, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Mountain Prairie Regional Director. Quote, if we are going to be able to conserve and recover endangered species now and in the future, partnerships such as the one we are entering into with the Cheyenne River Sioux are what is needed to help these programs succeed. The task of recovering ecosystems and the life that is dependent upon those areas is much too large for one entity to undertake. And moving to Hawaii, more than 60 wetland and shorebirds, many of them endangered species, have died at Maui's Kilai Han National Wildlife Refuge due to an outbreak of avian botulism. The disease, which does not affect humans, is caused by a bacteria that produces a toxin under certain conditions, including stagnant water, warm temperatures, and decaying vegetation. Thanks to several volunteers, we have been able to search the pond area several times a day to remove dead birds and bring weak birds to makeshift bird hospitals for rehabilitation, said Glynis Nakai, refuge manager. We're nursing 10 birds right now, and with the help of state veterinarian Dr. Greg Massey, we'll continue to make our rounds until we're sure the outbreak is over. Last Wednesday, 29 Hawaiian coots, 1 Hawaiian stilt, 29 koloa or hybrid Hawaiian ducks or hybrids, and 9 shorebirds had died from the disease. Hawaiian coots, stilts, and koloa are all endangered species. The botulism paralyzes the voluntary muscles of the birds, leading to drowning or asphyxiation. This has hit us at a terrible time of year with the fall migration bringing more and more shorebirds to the refuge, said Nakai. Soon waterfowl such as northern shovelers and pintails will be arriving after flying up to 2,400 miles across the ocean. We certainly don't want to attract them to Kealia Pond while the botulism is present, so we're keeping the pumps running in the smaller aquaculture ponds to better where better circulation keeps toxin levels down and turning off the pumps that deliver water to the main pond where the majority of dead birds have been found. This is the first major outbreak of avian botulism at Kealia Pond since the refuge was established in 1992. And the United States has become the 7th nation to ratify an international treaty designed to ensure the continued survival of 6 endangered species of sea turtles found in the Western Hemisphere. To bring the treaty into force, the Inter-American Convention must be ratified by 8 countries. So far, 7 nations, including Venezuela, Peru, Mexico, Brazil, Costa Rica, Ecuador, and the United States, have ratified it. Under the Inter-American Convention, participating countries agree to conserve sea turtle habitat, protect nesting beaches, limit intentional and accidental capture, and prohibit the international trade in sea turtles or their products, and support sea turtle research. Other countries have signed the treaty but not yet ratified it include Honduras and the Netherlands. And tourism groups are concerned and environmental groups are angry that British Columbia's chief forester has ordered logging in scenic areas of the province's north coast. Larry Pedersen announced last Friday that the allowable annual cut for the North Coast timber supply area would include part of British Columbia's Great Bear Rainforest, named after the rare white Kermode bear that lives there. The region is a huge draw for tourism to the province, particularly the burgeoning cruise ship industry between Vancouver, British Columbia, and Alaska. Environmental groups like the Vancouver-based Western Canada Wilderness Committee argue that the area slated for logging is the richest forest left, with the greatest biodiversity and wildlife and recreation values. The area represents prime grizzly and Kermode bear habitat, says the committee, while the valley bottom forests maintain pristine rivers essential to the long-term survival of salmon and British Columbia's increasingly lucrative ecotourism industry. How short-sighted can you get? Anyway, moving back to the U.S., responding to a court order, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has designated 4,000 acres of land in Orange and San Diego counties in California as critical habitat for the endangered San Diego fairy shrimp, a small vernal pool crustacean unique to Southern California. When the San Diego fairy shrimp was listed as endangered in 1997, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service concluded that designation of critical habitat was not prudent because it would make the species more vulnerable to habitat vandalism or destruction. In a lawsuit filed by the Southwest Center for Biodiversity, environmentalists argued that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has violated the Endangered Species Act by not designating critical habitat, and the court ordered the service to designate that habitat. The agency has proposed 36,501 acres of land as critical habitat for the fairy shrimp. And critical habitat has been designated in 513,000 acres of land in Southern California for the endangered coastal California gnatcatcher. The designated lands include portions of L.A., Orange, San Diego, San Bernardino, and Riverside counties. And hopefully in the final designation, the U.S. Fish and unfortunately in the final designation, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service omitted 289,000 acres of land included in its proposed critical habitat designation published earlier this year. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for news right now. To get news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, please send us email at cruzef@cruzio.com. That's C-R-U-Z-E-F at C-R-U-Z-I-O.com. Or you can send regular mail to Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, that's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061, and be sure to send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. If you want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address is P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. Once again, that's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440, and your first copy is free. You can listen to Earth First Radio live on your computer every Thursday night at 8 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time until we change to Pacific Standard Time here in just a few days. Go to the website www.microradio.net/FRSC and download the player. Then you can listen in to all the great shows on Free Radio Santa Cruz, including Earth First Radio. If you miss the show on Thursday nights, you can always find Earth First Radio archive shows on the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. The software you need to play the MP3 files is free on the website. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Please ask your local station to broadcast Earth First Radio. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, and portions of this newscast were prepared with the help of Stefan and Eon. And if you'd like to help prepare Earth First Radio, get in touch with us at cruzef@cruzio.com. We can use any volunteers in the Earth First Radio Collective. If you're in school and you want to do an internship with the Earth First Radio Collective, we can help arrange that. Our theme music was written and performed by Gerald Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis. Thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. And we're going to get down to Uncle Dennis's Earth First CD number one and listen to a song written by Gerald Cherney off of his Century tape cassette long time ago. Anyway, this one's called Sally Bell.
I'm here to sing the tale of Sally Bell, a heroine by all that's natural. She's fighting for the fir and redwood so they don't wind up as deadwood, to make room for the new Humboldt House Motel. Sally stands but 5'2" on tippy toes, but you ought to see the kind of clout she throws. She'll stand in front of a bulldozer screaming, "Buddy, don't come closer. That tree is gonna stand right where it grows." Give 'em hell, Sally Bell, give 'em hell. Seems like that's what they've been wanting, so you really might as well. Give 'em hell, Sally Bell, give 'em hell. Mother Nature's own crusader saved the redwood Sally Bell. Now Sally went on up to Centerville, where those Navy boys were doing their own will, tracking down those Russian nuke subs with these cameras size of bathtubs that they're dropping in the ocean for a spell. But Sally said, think boys no more. What, you tired of the redwoods? Now you want the ocean floor. But they had her quick arrested when an admiral protested that this little girl was blocking up his door. Give 'em hell, Sally Bell, give 'em hell. Seems like that's what they've been wanting, so you really might as well. Give 'em hell, Sally Bell, give 'em hell. Mother Nature's own crusader saved the ocean, Sally Bell. Well, they sentenced Sally Bell to 30 days. No thanks to old Judge Rowland, down old Fortuna way. He was banging on his gavel, trying to appease the rabble of the Navy, FBI, and CIA. Now I have to ask what kind of men these are, to put one like Sally Bell behind those bars. Now she's got the prison ranting, 'cause she's doing all this chanting, and the whole cell block's turned anti-nuclear. Give 'em hell, Sally Bell, give 'em hell. Seems like that's what they've been wanting, so you really might as well. Give 'em hell, Sally Bell, give 'em hell. Mother Nature's own crusader saved the planet, Sally Bell. Give 'em hell, Sally Bell, give 'em hell. Seems like that's what they've been wanting, so you really might as well. Give 'em hell, Sally Bell, give 'em hell. Mother Nature's own crusader saved the people.